The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated November 20, 2023. It's in a bright red front cover, and so as usual the outer border is in bright red with the inner border narrow and white. Time, T-I-M-E, is spelled in large block lettering, all capitals, in white against this bright red cover. Nobody believes in our victory like I do. Nobody is printed in black. That's the headline. The secondary headline, it's been nearly 2 years. Russia still controls a fifth of Ukraine's territory. Tens of thousands have been killed. Global support for the war is shrinking. And smaller print in white, the lonely fight of Volodymyr Zelensky by Simon Schuster. With that upper right-hand thumbprint turning space that says our 100th year on the cover. Beginning with the first article entitled The Brief. There's a photo here. The article is written by Sonia Mansour. The photograph by Youssef Massoud. Caption, struggling to care for the 2 million civilians caught in the Israel-Hamas war. This photograph, which is a full page, is in color, although there's a lot of dark brown, gray, sepia, black coloration in the background, which does fade to gray. In the foreground, a person wearing light blue scrubs, a man pointing with white gloved hands, while apparently a rescue worker carries a young child, a young boy, from some rubble. The rescue worker is dressed in black except for the bright orange vest and the headgear, which features a headlight or lamp, which is on. In his arms he carries a young boy, probably between the ages of 5 and 7, wearing now grubby red attire, shorts and a shirt. And the boy's dark hair is smattered with possibly concrete dust, but so are his feet and legs and his little hands. It looks like a light-colored mud, which it may be, or it may be concrete dust that's blown off the rubble. Also, his little face is smudged in that same clay, white, gray coloration. This is the brief opener. Within minutes of the October 31 Israeli attack on the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza, the victims began flooding the Indonesian hospital a mile away. Dr. Marwan Sultan, the hospital's medical director, says most of the injured and dead were women and children. Some had deep burns, serious head injuries, or missing limbs, Sultan told Time 4 hours after the attack. There are only 16 intensive care beds in the hospital, which was running dangerously low on fuel, threatening the lives of his patients. If the electricity goes, says Sultan, they will die. They will die. The conditions for medical care in Gaza are deteriorating across the besieged 140-square-mile coastal strip. Surgeons are operating by flashlight and rationing water, anesthesia, and generator fuel needed to perform surgeries, provide electricity for incubators, and care for kidney dialysis patients, doctors and health organizations tell Time. The roughly two dozen hospitals still operating in Gaza are absorbing the patients of the 12 that have closed because of a lack of supplies and the ongoing bombing, says the World Health Organization, WHO. Medical teams are on their knees, says Hisham Mahana, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. All war zones are awful, but Gaza presents a unique hell. Much of the enclave of 2 million is now a battlefield, with civilians and combatants intermixed, and homes and businesses sitting side by side with military infrastructure. Nowhere is that reality felt more keenly than at the territory's hospitals, which have simultaneously become safe havens and potential targets, and where the impact of Israel's offensive is measured every day in lives, more than 9,000 killed as of November 2, including 135 medical personnel, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. After the October 7 Hamas attacks that killed more than 1,400 people in Israel and started the war, the Israeli military began a massive bombing campaign. On October 13, it ordered civilians to depart the northern part of the Strip for the south, and on October 27, it sent in ground troops and armored vehicles. Hamas has fought back above and below ground from a network of concrete tunnels extending hundreds of miles. For the estimated 1 million people displaced by fighting, the search for shelter has brought many to makeshift tent cities. More than 50,000 are packed into the Al-Shifa hospital complex in northern Gaza, says Dr. Ghassan Abu Sita, a surgeon. Mattresses line the floor, kids run around, and a stench hangs in the air. So many people in such a small space with inadequate access to hygiene and sanitation will lead to an outbreak of infectious diseases, Abu Sita worries. Hospitals are struggling to dispose of dead bodies, which pose their own health hazards. Abu Sita has been going to a corner store to buy bottles of vinegar and laundry detergent to clean wounds. Every day you make more and more compromises, he says. Some two dozen hospitals have been asked to evacuate to the south, according to the WHO, which says doing so would risk patients' lives. When Israeli government officials called Al-Ada Hospital and told its manager, Dr. Ahmed Mahana, to evacuate staff and patients, I refused, of course, he says. Where can I deal with my patients? Doctors worry their facilities will be hit in the bombardment. October 30, an Israeli airstrike damaged part of Gaza's only cancer hospital, the Turkish-Palestinian Friendship Hospital, says its director, Dr. Sobi Sheikh. My message is please don't kill cancer patients, Sheikh says. November 1, the WHO said the hospital had shut down. Days before that, the Israeli Defense Forces presented evidence it said showed Hamas had established a command center in and beneath Al-Shifa Hospital. A Hamas official denied the allegation. Targeting a hospital would be a war crime, whether or not Hamas is using it to hide in, says Susan Akram, a law professor who directs Boston University's International Human Rights Clinic. Israel has an obligation to protect the entire population in Gaza, she says. For its part, Israel notes using a hospital to hide military equipment or facilities is itself a war crime. Even without a direct attack, the hospitals lack key supplies, which are coming in at a painfully slow pace amid the Israeli siege. October 31, the U.S. said 66 trucks of humanitarian aid were entering Gaza daily, a fraction of the hundreds per day before the war. fuel remains a critical issue. The Israeli military reportedly believes Hamas holds more than 500,000 liters it could provide to hospitals. The U.S. says it's pressuring Israel to break its blockade and allow aid in. President Biden called November 1 for a humanitarian pause in the war, but faces criticism for providing military aid to Israel. Everyone in Gaza has been affected. We often focus on the victims of airstrikes, says Dr. Brenda Kelly, a consultant obstetrician in Oxford, UK. But ordinary lives don't stop. Women still go into labor. They still have miscarriages, ectopic pregnancies, preterm births. Dr. Hatem Edher, the head of the neonatal intensive care unit at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, fears electricity shutting off will mean the deaths of 5 babies in his care who are dependent on ventilators. If there's no electricity, he says, it means the end of their life. Al-Ada Hospital's Mahana, speaking by phone, October 23 in southern Gaza, seemed unfazed by the sound of a blast during the interview. We are afraid. We are human beings, Mahana says, but we cannot do anything except continue our mission with our patients. That article was by Sonia Mansour, and here's a very short additional article by Anna Gordon. Takla, T-H-A-K-L-A, speaks to Gaza's grief. As war in Gaza continues, the Arabic word takla has taken on new significance. Referring to a parent, usually a mother, who has lost a child, it has appeared in classical Arabic for over 1,500 years and likely predates Islam, says Muhammad Salah Omri, a professor of modern Arabic literature at Oxford University, who adds there is no English equivalent for the word. With at least 3,000 children reported killed in Gaza as of November 1, many people are learning the word for the first time as it spreads across social media. Takla implies an emotion that goes beyond the reality of the loss. Mourning traditions in Arab culture can often include rituals of women wailing and performing eulogies in the poetic form or in rhyming prose. Takla involves these traditions, which go back thousands of years. For many Palestinians today, the term carries with it another meaning, Omri says. Many feel that simply living, including having children, can be a form of resistance. Children are a symbol, Omri says. This is why the mother figure is so central. She's someone not only who holds the collective memory of the land, but also is someone who gives birth to a new generation. And another additional smaller article, this one by Yasmin Serhan, What to Know About the Death Toll. October 25, President Joe Biden suggested the mounting Palestinian death toll in Gaza, which at the time stood at around 7,000, was not to be trusted. I'm sure innocents have been killed, Biden said, but I have no confidence in the number the Palestinians are using. The implicit reason was clear. The health ministry that tallies the figures, like all government departments in Gaza, falls under Hamas leadership. Hamas has a clear propaganda incentive to inflate civilian casualties as much as possible. Luke Baker, a former Reuters bureau chief who led its coverage of Israel in the Palestinian territories from 2014 to 2017, said in a recent X thread. Baker declined to comment to Time. The day after Biden's comment, Gaza's health ministry answered with a list of the dead. The 212-page document listed 6,747 people, who Palestinian officials said had been killed in Gaza since October 7. The list did not include 281 unidentified. Time was not able to independently verify the list, but news outlets, international organizations, and the U.S. State Department have long relied on Israeli and Palestinian government sources for casualty figures. Omar Shakir of Human Rights Watch says there have historically been no large discrepancies between their findings and those produced by Gaza's health ministry. There is a set process by which Palestinians track their casualties, says Noor Oda, a Ramallah-based political analyst. After every war, a list is issued with names, gender, age, ID number, and that happens for a reason, because you need to issue official death certificates. This process enables families to deal with issues such as inheritance and custody. This is not done by political figures. This compilation is done by health professionals, says Oda. And unfortunately, there's a lot of practice. What is lost is a caption for a two-page colored photo. The photograph is by Mohammed Salem, Reuters. A man grieves October 24 over bodies of Palestinian people killed in Israeli strikes in Khan Yunis, a city located in the southern half of the Gaza Strip, where the Israel Defense Forces had instructed residents to move for their own safety. The Palestinian Authority Health Ministry said more than 9,000 people had been killed as of November 2, as Israel mounted a massive retaliation for the October 7 surprise attack into Israel that killed some 1,400 people. This is both an easy and a difficult photograph to narrate. There are body bags, white canvas or plastic appearing body bags in a stack, and lying atop probably a row of three is a young-looking man. He has short hair, like a crew cut, and short facial hair. He's in profile, lying with his head upon these body bags. He's dressed in what I would call athletic attire, kind of a fleece jacket and pants set. It does have a logo on it that I can't read well enough to describe. Oh, it might be Nike. White lettering on top of the gray, and then the black jacket. Here's a one-page article under the brief news, The Bulletin, A Push for Stricter Gun Laws in Maine. It's written by Tara Law. Half of this article is a photograph. It's just a lot of people at night. Some are holding candles. Most look very somber. Men and women. I don't see any children, but the ages of the men and women appear to vary from teenagers to senior citizens. That caption reads, a vigil at the Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul for the Lewiston shooting victims, a push for stricter gun laws in Maine. A mass shooting that left 18 people dead at a bar in a bowling alley in Lewiston, Maine, October 25, is putting a spotlight on the state's legal laxity on gun safety. Specifically, Maine does not have some measures that have been shown to reduce gun deaths or homicides, such as laws that require gun permits, which some research found was associated with a 60% reduced risk of mass shootings, or universal background checks for handgun sales. In recent years, efforts to enact gun safety measures have floundered in Maine. In June, the state Senate rejected a bill that would have required background checks for private gun sales, including at gun shows, Instead, the state enacted a law prohibiting people from buying guns for someone banned from owning them. Michael Roque, an associate professor who has studied gun laws at Bates University in Lewiston, believes Maine has been slow to enact gun control, in part because residents tend to see the state as safe. In 2021, Maine had a gun death rate of 12.6 per 100,000, below the national average of 14.7. According to data from the National Center for Health Statistics, many residents have guns. As of 2016, about 45% of adults in the state were gun owners, compared with a national average of 32%, according to research from the RAND Corporation. While other states have embraced red flag laws, making it easier to confiscate guns from those deemed threats in emergencies, Maine currently has what has been called a yellow flag law, which requires getting a medical professional's opinion, in addition to a court order, to take someone's firearm temporarily. Critics say the law fails to adequately empower families to flag their relatives. Up until recently, the law was not strongly enforced, the Portland Press-Herald reported. The law was not used in this case, according to records from the Maine Attorney General's office. Maine's yellow flag law has received bipartisan support and could be a tool to prevent future tragedies. But policies that aim to reduce firearm violence are rarely going to be enough without the buy-in of community members responsible for law enforcement or implementation, says Rosanna Smart, co-director of RAND's Gun Policy in America initiative. Stricter laws would help, experts say, as Monisha Henley, senior vice president of government affairs at Every Town for Gun Safety, puts it. Gun laws really do save lives, and Maine doesn't have that many. The milestones page, we have five categories today. Beginning at the top, released a track that Paul McCartney called the last Beatles record, titled Now and Then, and written by John Lennon, November 2, with the help of AI. Streamed, Taylor Swift's 1989, Taylor's version, over 1 billion times in 3 days, after making her Spotify's most streamed artist in a single day when it dropped October 27. Launched, the presidential campaign of Democrat Dean Phillips, a Mississippi lawmaker, October 27, challenging incumbent President Joe Biden. Battered, Mexico's southern Pacific coast by Hurricane Otis, a Category 5 rapid intensification storm that hit Acapulco October 27 and killed at least 45 people. Died, healthcare activist Adi Barkan, who fought for Medicare for All of ALS, November 1 at 39. Bob Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, legendary Indiana basketball coach, November 1 at 83. Actor Richard Roundtree, who starred in Shaft, 1971, October 24 at 81. And the final person in the died category is Matthew Perry, Friends comic and recovery advocate. This is a longer article written by Olivia Ann Cleary and Megan McCluskey. There's a photo here of Matthew Perry. It's almost a quarter of a page in color, but it looks like black and white because he's wearing a black jacket and white shirt and standing in front of a green-black drapery or some kind of a hanging. And he's smiling at the camera. He looks young. He has short brown hair and I think bright brown eyes. Perry in 1997 during his run as Chandler Bing on Friends. And now to the text. When I die, I don't want Friends to be the first thing that's mentioned, Matthew Perry said. The actor may have been best known for playing the goofy and lovable Chandler Bing in the Juggernaut series, but his life was as defined by his struggles as it was by his iconic role. The best thing about me, bar none, is that if somebody comes to me and says, I can't stop drinking, can you help me? I can say yes and follow up and do it, he said in 2022. I want that to be the first thing that is mentioned, and I'm going to live the rest of my life proving that. Perry, 54, was found dead at his Los Angeles home October 28. He starred in Friends for 10 seasons, from 1994 to 2004, as the comedic core of the beloved television cast. Perry's masterly ability to switch between biting sarcasm and genuine emotion turned Chandler into the show's relatable anchor. In a joint statement, Perry's five main castmates, Jennifer Aniston, Courtney Cox, Lisa Kudrow, Matt LeBlanc, and David Schwimmer, called his passing an unfathomable loss. We are also utterly devastated by the loss of Matthew, they said. We were more than just castmates. We are a family. Perry also starred in films, such as 2000's The Whole Nine Yards and 2009's 17 Again. He battled addiction throughout, and in 2022 he released his much-anticipated memoir, Friends, Lovers, and The Big Terrible Thing. Within the bestseller, Perry opened up about his highly documented battle with addiction, detailing his grueling trips to rehab, interventions, and the multiple surgeries he had to endure after his health began to decline as a result of his lifestyle. Friends and co-stars of Perry's have paid tribute to his legacy of service to those in the grip of addiction. Hank Azaria, who appeared alongside Perry in a recurring role on Friends, spoke about how Perry personally helped him get sober. As a sober person, he was so caring and giving and wise, Azaria said. Perry may not have wanted Friends to be the first line of his obituary, but he will be remembered for both the joy he brought audiences and the care he provided to fellow addicts as a recovering advocate. He was always the funniest person in the room, the Friends creators and executive producer said in a statement. More than that, he was the sweetest, with a giving and selfless heart. Turning to the last page of today's edition of Time Magazine, where often we have the questions format. And this today is seven questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Today it features Caster Semenya, CasterSemenya, the South African gold medalist, on her new memoir, The Indignities of Gender Verification, and her future as an Olympic runner. This is by Sean Gregory, and again, it is in the question-answer format. There is a fairly small photo here in black and white of Caster Semenya, dressed in black with a geometric printed lapel. They also have, I would say, cornrows and very tight braids running at least shoulder length. A dark complexion, very dark eyes, slightly smiling at the camera, and I do see some shiny earrings, one on each ear. Question, you have two daughters, a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. Do you want them to run? Answer, no, I don't want my kids to go through what I went through, because as a woman, I know what they're going to go through. At the moment, they do swimming, which makes me so happy. I see future Olympic champions there. Question, why write The Race to Be Myself now? Answer, you want to tell a story when you're in a good state of mind, when you're at peace. I thought it's about time I support those who need me. It is a reminder to those out there who feel rejected that they belong. The most important thing you can do for yourself is just to accept yourself for who you are. Question, you were a talented soccer player growing up. You write, however, that running turns your mind inward, and team sports like soccer turn it outward, and you prefer inward. What do you mean? Answer, well, in team sports, it's never about me alone. We have to go sit as a team to fix the problem, which may not be fixed. When I'm running, I feel free because I have no worries. My loss is my loss. My win is my win. Question, the first time you met your future wife, she confused you for a boy in the locker room. From the outside, that could seem offensive, but you write about it as almost a point of pride. Why? Answer, if you know yourself, how you are, how you look, it is what it is. So when someone will say, hey, you're a boy, I will correct you. It was always my responsibility to guide, to educate people. Yes, I may like shorts, I may like vests, but I'm a woman. I was just like, if I was a guy, why would I be in this room? I did not take it personally. We had a connection. We became friends. From there, we start understanding one another. We become a unit. Question, for the first time, you talk in detail about the two gender verification tests you had to undergo before your breakout performance at the 2009 World Championships. What was the toughest part of that experience? Answer, when you have nothing to hide, you won't say it's tough. I wanted to show these people, look, what you're doing is wrong. You're not going to find anything. Only you have a high testosterone level. You are a woman who has no uterus, a woman with no fallopian tube. You are a woman with internal testicles. Publicizing this, they have done me a favor. You are educating people about differences in a human being. That was not humiliating. What was humiliating was how they treated me. Question, you write about how your legal team made an agreement with the track and field world governing body. The organization would let you compete if you took contraceptive pills to lower testosterone levels. You call this intervention poison. What was the most difficult moment while taking the medication? Answer, you're taking these things, and for what? They make you sick. They take the soul out of you. You're no longer living based on what you are supposed to be. It was dark. That is why I wrote in the book, if you are going to take that route, you must know you are ending your life. You are just booking your casket. Question. The European Court of Human Rights found in July that a Swiss court had failed to uphold human rights norms despite credible claims of discrimination. If the regulations are overturned, would you try to run in the Olympics, if not in Paris, then in Los Angeles in 2028? Answer, I have not decided either way whether I'd run or not. For me, the hope is that such rulings are never made again. Human rights need to be considered. People need to be treated with dignity and respect. I am fulfilled if those young girls can go run. Enjoy their youth. Enjoy their teenage life. Enjoy sport. As much as you say, sport is for all, at the moment, it is not. Time Off Reviews Television. Nathan Fielder's Hitchcockian Head Trip by Judy Berman. the third episode of Showtime's strange, riveting, and often hilarious new series, The Curse, the married co-hosts of an in-development reality show watch a focus group respond to the pilot. "I like the lady," says one woman. "I do wish he had a sense of humor or a personality. There's zero sexual tension," another participant complains. The final verdict? "There was just something off about him. Like I said, either be hot or funny. He wasn't either to me." The character in question, Asher Siegel, is played by co-creator Nathan Fielder. Of the high-concept reality comedies, The Rehearsal and Nathan for You. And the persona he adopts here shares much with the fictionalized versions of himself that he has portrayed in those series. Awkward, pushy, disconcertingly affectless. Genre-wise, The Curse is a different kind of show. What begins as a scripted satire of HGTV real estate porn builds tension until it becomes, of all things, a Hitchcockian psychological thriller. Fielder's inscrutable presence is as pivotal to building suspense as it was in setting the offbeat tone for his past projects. Asher and his wife of 1 year, Whitney, Emma Stone, have moved to the small, economically depressed New Mexico city of Española on a mission to reinvigorate the community by building environmentally friendly houses. Aware that these expensive dwellings are bound to displace low-income residents, the socially conscious couple plan to offset the inevitable gentrification by attracting new businesses, including a high-end coffee chain and a designer denim boutique that will create jobs for unemployed Espanolans. They are also, of course, hoping to become the next Chip and Joanna Gaines. The driving force behind this dream is Whitney, a rich girl rebelling against, without necessarily achieving financial independence from, slumlord parents. Stone's inherent warmth suffuses her performance while making Whitney come across at first as a humane corrective to the seemingly robotic Asher. Yet as the 10-episode series unfolds, her desperation to be seen as not just a good person, but also an authentic member of a discreet community like her Jewish husband and her Native American friend Kara Nijonia Austin, takes on an increasingly sinister cast. A more initially alarming character is Asher's old friend Dougie, co-creator Benny Safdie, of the brother duo behind Uncut Gems and Good Time, the sketchy producer helming the HGTV show, whose abysmal working title is Flipanthropy. When we meet Dougie, he's inducing tears of gratitude in a scene in which the Siegels secure a barista job for the adult son of a cancer-stricken woman by spraying water and menthol in the mother's face. Later in a parking lot, one of Dougie's contrivances backfires. A little girl, Hikma Warsami, is selling cans of soda, and Dougie goads Asher into buying one on camera. Asher has only a $100 bill, so he gives it to her for the sake of the shot, and then, in the kind of tone-deaf faux pas that makes Whitney apoplectic, takes it back. "I curse you," the child proclaims. Chaos reigns in the aftermath of that portentous encounter, but it is hard to blame the words of a wronged elementary schooler or even Asher for provoking her when the Siegels, Dougie, and the whole Flipanthropy project are sowing as much toxicity as they reap. I'm going to spell that name, Flipanthropy, Flipanthropy. Fielder's eternal preoccupation is the way people manipulate their environments and one another, particularly through reality TV, where reality is so vulnerable to meddling. Here he applies that scrutiny to a couple who yearn to be the heroes of a story in which they are clearly self-interested interlopers and a producer who will cross any line of decency if it helps his show get picked up. While The Curse is sure to elicit nervous giggles, the mismatch between Fielder's stiffness and Stone's ease makes for great physical comedy. It more often conjures a state of paranoia. At first, Whitney and Asher worry about how Dougie is depicting them. But as the season progresses, and locals from poor, immigrant, and indigenous communities rightfully begin to distrust their motives, the Seagulls redirect that suspicion onto everyone around them. Does the local media have it out for them? Is the crew whispering about them? Is she making fun of me? Whitney demands when Kara, recruited to appear on Flip-lanthropy, ad-libs a goofy character. Behind the camera, Softee's influence is palpable in the stark aesthetic sensibility honed by his and Brother John's anxiety-inducing filmography. From claustrophobic, verite-style cinematography to a ringing, buzzing score from avant-jazz composer John Medeski. From a technical as well as a thematic standpoint in its three complementary lead performances, and ultimately in one of the weirdest go-for-broke finales in the history of TV, The Curse is a brain-breaking revelation on par and of a piece with the rehearsal. Once again, it is Fielder, a man whose face seems frozen in a flinch at the constant awareness of his own existence in this humiliating world, who makes the experience so transcendently uncomfortable. The Curse premiered November 12 on Showtime. Time off reviews, movies. A Hitman Who's Strong to the Finish by Stephanie Zakarik. If you have been watching movies for a while, David Fincher's The Killer, which arrived November 10 on Netflix, might be your 100th movie about a contract killer, or even your 500th. It is a genre that springs eternal. Yet modern directors often think they need to make these stories elaborate and convoluted to keep an audience engaged, when maybe the opposite is true. That is what makes Fincher's movie a cut above. Instead of overloading his story with fussy layers, he pares everything back to the genre's essence. What we're left with is a killer and his conscience, or whatever he's got that might pass for one. In Fincher's hands, that narrowed focus expands the genre's possibilities rather than shrinking them, especially with an actor like Michael Fassbender at the center of it all, playing a radiantly ruthless killer with no name and no shame. Or at least that's what this murderer for hire wants us to believe. In the picture's extended, languorous, but taut opening, Fassbender's character, let's call him Nameless Killer Man, sets up shop in an abandoned Parisian WeWork space, training his sights on a window across the street, waiting for a chance to put a bullet in his mark. This means a lot of waiting. And we pass the time with Nameless Killer Man as he runs through an efficient set of yoga poses. He intensifies his focus with music filtered through earbuds. He's a big Smiths fan. After changing out of his stretchy assassin gear into an even more anonymous-looking outfit, a look modeled, he tells us, on a German tourist he saw in London, he heads down to the street for some recon. Through it all, he spins out streams of assassin bon mot in voiceover, "Trust no one. Each and every step of the way, ask what's in it for me." And my personal favorite, Popeye the Sailor probably said it best, "I am what I am." Nameless Killer Man has many thoughts about his work ethos, and he shares them with us in a kind of interior monologoria. Is the whole movie going to be this way? It seems possible. But at last, after hours of watching that window, he thinks he's got his shot and hits the wrong person. Suddenly, the killer bursts into a fireball of controlled chaos. Fincher moves through every step of the plot with poetic precision. Nameless killer man zips off on a motorbike, at one point executing the classic vrooming down the steps move. He boards a plane under the name Felix Unger, the first of many aliases drawn from 70s American TV. It turns out that nameless killer man does have a heart, which we discover when he finds out that the person he loves best has, thanks to his mistake, been brutalized by savage baddies. To redress this wrong, he must locate the anonymous individual who ordered the hit he botched, and his vengeful trek takes him to New Orleans, Florida, and New York, at which point Tilda Swinton shows up, cool as a stick of spearmint gum. Fincher seems to be having a great deal of fun here, though he takes the killer seriously as a piece of action craftsmanship. There's some nifty hand-to-hand combat shot in tasteful low light. The sight of two silhouettes beating the crap out of each other becomes a kind of shadow puppetry. Through it all, Fassbender makes a marvelous nameless killer man with a secret conscience. In his finest sequence, he sits very still, listening closely to the person he loves best, absorbing the reality of just what this person endured to protect his identity. The restrained anguish on his face tells us everything. Like Popeye, he is what he is. Only unlike Popeye, he's much too understated to brag about it. Returning to television and another review by Judy Berman, Only Murders at the Billionaire's Retreat. A Murder at the End of the World is a tricky title. It might refer to a murder in a remote location, or a murder amid the literal end times. In the case of FX's smart, stylish new drama, it is a true double entendre. The plot works on multiple levels, too. Set up as a classic, cozy mystery, the detective story grounds an investigation of technology and enterprise in the age of climate apocalypse. Are the world's wealthiest innovators saving humanity or hastening our demise? This combination of thematic ambition and narrative complexity will be familiar to fans of creators Britt Marling and Zal Batmanghali's previous TV project, Netflix's spiritual sci-fi puzzle box, The O.A. Murder. Is a more grounded show. Oh, the OA, the puzzle box, is the OA, and Murder is a more grounded show, trading heady speculation for terrifying reality. So-called Gen Z Sherlock Holmes, Darby Hart, Emma Corrin, The Crown's young Diana, has published a true crime memoir chronicling how she and her then-boyfriend, Bill Harris Dickinson, as teenagers, hunted a serial killer. The book attracts the attention of tech billionaire Andy Ronson, Clive Owen, and his wife Lee Marling, a pioneering hacker, who invite her to an exclusive retreat at their high-tech hotel in the snowiest reaches of Iceland. The topic is the world's bleak future, and the guests an intimidating group of artists, scientists, entrepreneurs, and activists. When bodies start to drop, Darby hacks the hotel's extensive surveillance tech to investigate. Some episodes are too long, and the season sags in the middle. Like the OA, Murder could use a dash of humor to vary the somber tone. But these are small complaints when Marling and Batmanghali have so thoughtfully built an inquiry into the consequences of AI and surveillance capitalism within the framework of a whodunit, yielding a mystery both current and timeless. This next lengthy article, which will be abridged, is under the heading 2030 Health, Should We End Obesity? The weight loss drug explosion has forced a reconsideration of what healthy means, by Jamie Ducharme. It's unusual for a medication to become a household name, even more uncommon for its branding to become like Advil, shorthand for an entire class of products, and rarest of all for it to change not just U.S. medicine, but U.S. culture. Ozempic, O-Z-E-M-P-I-C, has done all three. Approved in 2017 as a type 2 diabetes medication, Ozempic has largely made its name and a fortune for its manufacturer, Novo Nordisk, as a weight loss aid. Its runaway success mirrors that of similar medications, including Eli Lilly's Mounjaro and Wegovy, another Novo Nordisk product, and the only one in the trio technically approved for weight loss. Prescriptions for all of them are flying off the pad at an eye-popping rate. They are up 300% since early 2020, with more than 9 million written in the U.S. in the last 3 months of 2022 alone, according to healthcare industry research firm Trilliant Health. Demand is so great there have been shortages of all three drugs, with some diabetes patients struggling to fill their prescriptions as they compete for limited supplies. Plenty of physicians and pharmaceutical executives who stand to get very, very rich say this frenzy is a good thing, given that roughly three-quarters of U.S. adults qualify as either overweight or obese and are thus, according to leading public health authorities, at risk of a range of serious health complications. Obesity is an epidemic, and we urgently need effective treatments, says Dr. Sahar Takush, an obesity and bariatric medicine specialist at Vanderbilt Health. But others are uneasy about the age of Ozempic, which can feel like a return to an era when thinness was unquestioningly valued. Before the Ozempic tsunami, there was growing support for the Association for Size Diversity and Health's principles of health at every size, which hold that body size is not a measure of health or worth, and all people deserve non-stigmatizing medical care. The group's influence contributed to the rise of weight-neutral medicine, which sees weight and health as separate, and worked in tandem with the wider body positivity movement to loosen the diet industry's vice-like grip on American psyches. As the 2000s progressed, women's magazines stopped pushing diets quite so hard. Clothing brands bragged about hiring models larger than a size zero. Even Weight Watchers rebranded as a wellness company called WW. Then Ozempic and its cohort came along, and it turned out lots of people still wanted to be skinny. In fact, some industry watchers predict the rise of Ozempic and its ilk could spell the end of obesity. But as these drugs transform both standard medical practice and cultural ideas about weight loss, a contentious debate is simmering beneath the surface. Should we even be treating obesity? Obesity is a common, serious, and costly chronic disease, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, afflicting more than 40% of U.S. adults and almost 20% of children, and putting them at risk of health problems, including heart disease, type 2 diabetes, stroke, and some types of cancer. If obesity is a disease, it follows logically, it should be treated. Historically, that has meant prescribing diet and exercise as plan A. But in practice, try as we might, a lot of exercise typically does not result in a significant amount of weight loss, says Glenn Gesser, a professor of exercise physiology at Arizona State University. That is in part because people get hungrier the more they move, offsetting whatever calories they burn at the gym, and in part because the body tends to get used to its size and work to stay at that set point. Gesser explains, lifestyle changes can work for some people, but many lose only modest amounts of weight or regain the pounds over time, a process known as weight cycling that is itself linked to cardiovascular and metabolic health problems. For a long time, doctors had relatively few options to offer patients for whom diet and exercise did not work, things like metformin, a type 2 diabetes drug that also causes a modest amount of weight loss, and bariatric surgery, which is effective, but few patients opt into. And then came Ozempic. Dr. Mara Gordon minimized weight's role in her practice, focusing instead on other markers of health, things like insulin resistance, blood pressure, chronic pain, mental health, and the quality of life. Gordon says, I wish we lived in a less superficial society, but my job is to take care of the patient right in front of me. In the end, she often writes the prescription. And again, that lengthy article was abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.